Eyes and Knives, copyright Pete Malicki, Helm Publishing 2009, audio recording part 1. Tuesday, afternoon. In the final minutes before he died, Paul Hirsch was bored. This was somewhat appropriate, given that he spent his final minutes in a board meeting. His final seconds were spent hurtling towards the ground from the 20th floor of the building he worked in. While Paul had been alive, he'd worked as an executive manager for a large corporation, a corporation whose sole focus was profit. Where one organisation might shy away from a particular deal because they were concerned with ethics, Paul's corporation would be there with open pockets, smiling faces, and a well-oiled PR team. There might even be a conspiracy theorist out there who claimed they were involved in activities that made your run-of-the-mill corruption look like child's play. Some people say that money doesn't make you happy. You can't buy love and friendship with plastic notes and pieces of metal. These people would claim that being a puppet in a large, profit-driven corporation with no moral standards is enough to pull the thread of one's conscience to breaking point. One day you might reflect on what you do for a living and think, hey, I'm the scum of the earth. Where's a bridge I can drive my Audi off? But Paul Hirsch wasn't one for self-doubt. He loved his job. He loved his job, he loved his expensive car, he loved the gorgeous young woman who had married him for status, and most of all, he loved his money. What he wasn't particularly fond of was board meetings, because they bored him to death. Well, not literally. At least not often. This particular board meeting had something to do with retention and staff incentives. The workers in the call centre had been complaining about the high level of abuse they copped from disgruntled clients, so the senior management team was coming up with ways to placate them. Offer them rewards for excellent service? Give them discount vouchers or tickets to the movies? Award them a commission for every new client they sign up? Hire some massage guys to rub their shoulders once a month. None of these ideas would make a real difference, though. This corporation had better things to do with its time than worry about staff. Paul Hirsch lost the thread of the meeting somewhere around upgrading the lunchroom coffee machine. He let his thoughts drift over to his colleagues' breasts. They were quite nice breasts. Paul had given them an 8 out of 10, top marks for their curvy shape, a size and fullness that any bikini model would be proud of, and several packed elevator rides had confirmed a good level of suppleness. She lost the 2 points on the way her nipples pointed outwards. Occasionally, when breast enhancement surgery went awry, the silicon implant would be inserted so that it displaced the nipples laterally. Jenna Albright, for that was her name, had never undergone breast surgery, but most of the men from the senior management team would have bet their own mothers that she had. When Jenna had caught Paul staring, he'd quickly turned his gaze to his coffee mug, the mug with the name of his corporation emblazoned on it. Star Market Systems, it said in glittery golden black text. This mug was the last thing he ever remembered. Without warning, Paul Hirsch leapt to his feet, knocking his mug onto the carpet where it smashed into 5 or 6 jagged pieces. The entire senior management team stopped their creative brainstorming and looked up at him. If there's one thing you can do to get attention, it's breaking something. What are you doing, Paul? Asked the head of communications. Paul was vainly attempting to overturn the mahogany meeting table. He grunted and growled like a hurt animal, then abruptly ceased his efforts and dropped into a crouch. The man to his right, a long-standing manager at Star Market Systems, jumped up and stumbled behind his chair, afraid that Paul would attack him. Is this supposed to be a suggestion on how we can improve staff morale, Paul? Because I don't understand. The CEO trailed off as he watched his most senior manager run at full speed towards the window. There was a dull thud, followed by a chorus of gasps from the table. The window did not shatter, but a long crack appeared in the glass, spreading out like the forked branches of a lightning bolt. Paul Hirsch half turned towards the senior management team, snarling as he looked from face to face. Before anyone moved, he turned back to the window and started punching it. The crack widened and shards showered out, creating a hole large enough for him to leap out of. He leaped. Tuesday, evening.
Did you hear that, honey? Some guy fell out of a 30-story building and almost landed on a pram. Apparently the mother abandoned her baby and ran off at full speed. She hasn't been seen since.
Rod Fitzgerald hated his wife. He hated the way she slouched on the lounge, peering at the TV screen over the rim of her glass of gin. He hated the way she paraphrased the news, firstly because she dumbed everything down as if he were an idiot, and secondly because he could hear it anyway. He hated the vast number of outfits she wore, and he hated her inability to stick with an activity for more than 2 weeks. He hated her obnoxious laugh, and he hated her parents. He hated her best friend because she was superficial and boring and looked like she'd been beaten into a coma with an ugly stick.
Are you listening to me, Rodney Fitzgerald?
He hated the way she referred to him by his full name. "No, dear, I'm not," Rod replied pleasantly. "Would you like some dinner with your liver cancer?" Jennifer Fitzgerald tipped the dregs of her gin into her mouth and swallowed. She insisted on being called Jennifer rather than Jenny or Jen, and Rod hated that too.
"As long as it isn't that shitty pasta you usually make," she said.
Rod looked at the meal he'd just made. He ladled out a plateful of shitty pasta and took it into the study. "Suit yourself," he called as he switched on his laptop. 7 seconds later, the computer was up and running and ready to go. It was a supercomputer, the likes of which are normally owned by governments and intelligence agencies. Rod didn't work for the government, but for Star Market Systems. If you looked at his official documentation, you would be thoroughly convinced that Rod Fitzgerald worked in the call center of a multinational marketing corporation. You would believe that he was on a generous salary of $72,000 per annum, with full entitlements and year-round discount parking. If you looked hard enough, you may even catch a sniff of a brief affair with the boss's teenage daughter. What you wouldn't find in any documents anywhere is that Rod Fitzgerald worked as a scientist in the R&D department of the world's largest technology company. You'd have no idea that he was on a yearly salary of over $1 million, which didn't include his personal doctor and expensive sports car, and you certainly wouldn't find even the slightest hint that he had 4 kills under his belt. Rod opened the document he was currently working on. It was a presentation on how DNA could be replicated indefinitely without a reduction in the size of telomeres. He hated the fact that his wife was so fucking stupid she actually believed he made enough money from telemarketing to buy a sports car, but he loved the fact that he had deceived her so successfully she didn't even know his real name.
"Honey, I'm sorry I was rude about your cooking. I'm really quite fond of your pasta."
Jennifer was standing in the doorway, a plate of spaghetti in one hand and a fork in the other. Years of drinking and smoking had left her much worse off than when Rod had selected her, but the various exercise programs she undertook had kept her body in serviceable shape. "Come here, Jennifer," Rod said as he swiveled his chair around to face the door. "Show me just how sorry you are." His 32-year-old wife slipped across the room and sat down on his lap, grinding her firm hips back and forth.
"Do you like it when I do this, honey?"
Rod hated how his wife always asked him if she liked what he was doing. "Yeah, I like it," he replied honestly. "You know what else I like, don't you?"
"Silence, I know."
He smiled and grabbed Jennifer by the shirt, bringing her mouth close to his. Seconds later, they were kissing passionately and tearing each other's clothes off. Rod Fitzgerald hated his wife, but he still loved watching her face while she rode his genetically enhanced cyber penis. Wednesday, early morning. "Tickets, please." A young man named Rory Henderson took a sharp breath. He clenched his jaw tight and his eyes darted around the carriage. There was no escape. He had to think of something quickly.
"Sir, your ticket, please."
"Sir?"
"Sir!"
"Huh? What's up?" Rory rubbed his bleary eyes and looked up at the young man standing before him. He was tall, but his build was slight. A dark uniform and the badge in his left hand identified him as a transit officer. That is, a glorified ticket inspector. Rory was sure he could take him.
"Can I see your ticket, please, sir?" "Shit, I must have fallen asleep. What station are we at?"
"Almost Helm, sir. Your ticket."
"Helm? Damn, I've missed my stop."
The inspector reached for his radio at the same time that Rory clambered to his feet.
"I wouldn't try to leave, sir. I'm going to have to write you a ticket."
"That's not fair, mate. I fell asleep and missed my stop."
"Can you show me your ticket?"
Rory looked at the man's radio. Inspectors travelled in groups and it wouldn't be wise to attack one of them.
"I lost it. My wallet was stolen."
The inspector smiled a humorless smile.
"Was it really?
You won't be able to bribe me then, will you? What a shame." He started filling out one of the forms on his notebook, ignoring Rory's bewildered look.
"Bribe you, eh? I think I might have a bit of money in my sock, you know."
Rory wasn't sure if the inspector was being serious or sarcastic, so he kept his tone lightly jocular. Was attempting to bribe a rail inspector considered an offence? Could he end up owing the bloody government even more money?
$50 would do you fine, no pun intended.
$50, Rory repeated as he reached into his pants and pulled out his wallet. "I think that is a reasonable price, sir. It is a 75% reduction in the overall cost of the fine. You needn't worry about your criminal record either." The train was nearing Helm Station.
Is this a trick? Because you can't make that kind of offer. It's entrapment.
Give me your name or your money, sir.
Rory Henderson took a $50 bill out of his wallet and handed it to the inspector, who took it wordlessly and left the carriage. The train pulled to a stop at Helm, and the inspector alighted. Rory looked out the window. Four burly transit officers were boarding the train. His jaw dropped as he watched the guy he'd just bribed run away at full speed. Wednesday, morning. It was barely light and the city streets were already crammed full of people. Most of them had just roused from the daily coma of train travel, the perfection of their business outfits contrasting with the glazed looks in their eyes. Sol had been staying on the streets for such a long time that he saw right through these people. To him, they were rats, willing to do just about anything to get what they wanted. You'd never catch Sol supplicating to a machine, or speaking to an enraged and unreasonable client with false sincerity. He may occasionally eat leftover McDonald's from garbage bins, but he had his pride. Right now, the homeless man was captivated by the sight of a young woman standing outside an electronics store, staring intently at a flickering television set. Her clothes looked new, though her trousers were torn right down one side. There was dried blood caked to her hands, and her weight clearly favoured one leg. Sol watched as a man approached this woman, frowning with concern as he eyed her dishevelled appearance. He was dressed casually and looked about 30.
"Excuse me, ma'am, are you all right?"
The woman wheeled around to face the man, hissing and dropping into a crouch. She made an attempt to move forward, but lost her footing, crashing awkwardly onto her chest and face. She crawled to her knees as the man rushed over to assist her.
"Let me help you. Were you attacked?"
The events that happened next were so bizarre that Sol wondered if he hadn't eaten a bad cheeseburger. The man, who had been bending over to help the woman up, suddenly jerked backwards and spun around. For no discernible reason, he started running, and he continued running until he was out of sight. At the same time, the woman convulsed violently on the concrete, arms and legs kicking out in all directions. Then suddenly, she was still. After what seemed like minutes, but was probably more like seconds, she dragged herself into a sitting position and looked around the street, obviously disorientated.
"What happened?" she mumbled. "Where am I?"
The woman climbed to her feet, wincing and frowning at the pains in her leg and hands. From her body language, it looked very much like she'd just woken up.
"My baby! Where's my baby?"
She took a few desperate steps, then collapsed as her leg gave way beneath her. Sol frowned, bit his lower lip, and shuffled away as the woman started shrieking at the top of her voice. Wednesday, early afternoon. Ian Albright counted his takings. $1,230, a pretty girl's phone number, and a packet of gum. Not bad for the middle of the week. Not bad at all. The tall man stripped out of his stolen transit officer's uniform and dressed in something more casual. He threw his wig of long brown hair on the carpet and strode into the kitchen, where he made and ate a quick bread and jam sandwich. Leaving the plate for his girlfriend to wash up, he strolled into the lounge room, sat down, and turned on the television. A celebrity chef smiled at the camera and the ads came on. First up was a news update, and it reminded Ian of something he'd heard on the radio that morning. He took out his phone and dialed.
"Yo, sis, how's it going?"
30 kilometres away, a woman sighed into her phone.
"Ian, what do you want?" "I don't have time to keep you entertained."
"There's no need to be so bad-tempered," Ian said good-naturedly. "I heard on the news about some guy falling out of a building in the city. Thought you might have seen some blood or guts or something." The woman sighed.
"Listen to me, little brother. I'm very busy. Some of us, the ones who have jobs, don't have the luxury of sitting around all day making pointless phone calls. We live in a pretty large city, and I don't see every little thing that happens in it, okay?"
"Look like the building you work in to me," Ian countered.
Oops, my other phone's ringing. See you later." "I made $1,200, Ian said quickly, but the call had already been disconnected.
He continued anyway.
"Yeah, well, some of us have jobs we're not supposed to talk about, bitch. Some of us make a lot more money and enemies than stupid marketing executives, but we're definitely not responsible for as much anger and hatred."
Throwing his mobile onto the carpet, Ian picked up the remote and changed to Oprah. He lay down on the couch and stared blankly at the roof, letting his mind roam free. It's a well-known fact that everyone has a secret. Sometimes they're small and insignificant, sometimes they're monumental. Either way, they always affect the person keeping them. Most people have secrets about themselves, little things they've said or done that they're ashamed to speak about. An example, a man named Billy Winter had been married for 35 years before he died in a rock fishing accident, never telling a single soul about the brief affair he'd had with his maths teacher, Mr. Benedict. This was the kind of secret that is easy to keep, and that's because Billy didn't want anyone to know about it. Secrets about other people tend not to remain secrets for very long because there is such a strong temptation to disclose them. Had Billy told either of his children about the aforementioned liaison, they would have almost certainly told their mother at some point in time. If you don't tell anyone your secret, they can't betray you. Ian's thoughts drifted to his own secret. It fit better in the monumental category than in the insignificant one. He disliked the fact that he couldn't even tell his sister what his secret was. She had remained one of his closest friends throughout his life, and it cut him every time he lied and said he was on welfare. The closest he got to telling her the truth was when he laughingly told her he was employed by the government. A buzzing sound roused Ian from his thoughts. His phone was vibrating around in a small circle on the carpet, a light flashing on its screen. He stooped down to pick it up. Yeah?
Ian, we just received an interesting report. Clean yourself up and come to the office immediately.
Righto. Ian got up off the couch and rushed into his bedroom, where he changed into a singlet and some very short shorts. Minutes later, he left the house jogging. Wednesday. Midday.
Fuck!
Yelled Rod Fitzgerald as he stepped full force on the brake pedal. The coffee which had been sitting on his lap bounced up against the dashboard and exploded, showering hot liquid all over his face, arms and clothing. Incensed, the scientist from Star Market Systems flung the driver's side door open with the full intention of screaming his lungs out at the fool who just stepped in front of his vehicle. As he was struggling out of his seatbelt, a motorcyclist slammed into his open door and went flying through the air. The bike skidded across the road and Rod's door came off one of its hinges. Before he could comprehend what had just happened, another car came screeching into him from behind. Inertia caused Rod's head to smash violently into the frame of the door. He blacked out, slid off his seat, and landed heavily on the road. A few seconds later, he was stumbling over towards the car that had just rear-ended him. He barely knew what he was doing. It was a struggle to stay on his feet. His vision danced, and sound came to him in throbbing waves.
"Are you okay, man?"
came a male voice.
I don't know, Rod managed in reply. He slumped against the side of his car and took a few deep, even breaths.
I'm so sorry about that, man. You just hit the brakes so hard I couldn't avoid driving into the back of you. Man, what's with that dick running across a four-lane road? Look at this, he's caused a major fucking accident. Whoa, look out!
Rod slowly turned around. A man wearing leather and a cracked motorcycle helmet was limping towards him, holding a metal pipe in his hand. Even in his dazed state, he knew that this was the motorcyclist coming to get him.
Leave him alone, man. It wasn't his fault. Don't make me call the cops on you.
The motorcyclist, Aaron Knowles, didn't slow down a step. At this point in time, he didn't give the slightest toss about the police. He was focused on one thing and one thing only, and that was knocking a half dozen teeth out of the motherfucker who just opened his car door without looking to see who might be coming up on his inside. Lots of cyclists and motorcyclists had been hurt or even killed by people doing this, and Aaron was ready to deal out vengeance on all their behalves. But there was something that Aaron didn't know. There was a lesson he had never learned, and it proved to be his downfall. If you've ever met a really good fighter, you would know the importance of not judging books by their covers. The common perception is that martial arts is practiced solely by adolescents, steroid-pumped meatheads, and little Chinese guys with long white goatees and flared shirts. This perception is, mostly, a false one. What people don't consider is that there are some pretty ordinary-looking characters out there who could break both your arms faster than you could count to four. It could be a 5-foot accountant, a bald man, or an overweight woman. Aaron Knowles had never considered that. Hence he came at Rod with full confidence and no apprehension. Rod Fitzgerald was an average-looking guy. He was 40 years old, a fraction under 6 feet, wore an expensive suit and had short brown hair with a swirl of grey in it. He was well proportioned, but carried a few extra kilos. Not exactly what you'd describe as menacing. Aaron took a wild swing at Rod's head with the metal pipe he'd removed from his bike. A few seconds later, Aaron had learnt that lesson. Even in his dazed state, Rod easily managed to duck his attacker's blow and catch the pipe on its backswing. He wrenched it free and whirled it around to crash down on Aaron's helmet, knocking him onto the ground. An old reflex then made him drop his weight elbow first onto the big man's hamstring, a technique that would have anyone limping for days but wouldn't cause permanent damage. More than a dozen people were watching as Rod climbed woozily to his feet. He looked around, noticing that at least 6 other cars had been involved in the accident. When the bike had skidded onto the far side of the road, it had hit 2 cars and caused a 3rd to swerve into a phone booth.
Holy shit, man! You fucking wasted that, dude! Where'd you learn to do those crazy moves, man?
Rod turned to the excitable young man standing before him and scowled. Given what he had just done to the motorcyclist, his scowl looked particularly unfriendly. Primary school, he said. He staggered over to his car and climbed inside, ignoring the many eyes that followed his movements. There was no point hanging around and wasting his time with the police. It seemed unlikely, with all the excitement, that anyone would have bothered taking his registration number down, so he'd be able to drive off without getting caught. The engine was still on. Much to the amazement of the spectators, Rod Fitzgerald started driving, manoeuvring his damaged car away from the scene of the accident. Because, you see, he still had a fool to scream his lungs out at. In the few minutes since causing the accident, the so-called fool had made good distance. His high speed was partly because of the mayhem he'd just caused, and partly to do with the fact that he thought he was about to die. Peter Steyer thought over and over again, "If I don't keep running, I'm going to die. If I don't keep running, I'm going to die." A car pulled up beside him as he half-jogged and half-stumbled his way along. One of its doors was scraping along the road, leaving a trail of sparks in its wake. "What the hell do you think you're doing, buddy?" said the driver. "You've ruined my damn car." "I'm sorry," Peter said breathlessly, "but I couldn't help it. I'm going to die if I stop moving." Rod snorted. "What? Is your heart pedal-powered or something?" Peter turned in a wide semicircle and started jogging back in the direction he'd come from. When he glanced back, he noticed with much dismay that the car was reversing towards him.
"Leave me alone, please," Peter begged. "It's a matter of life and death."
"Don't give me that shit. You have a pretty big damage bill to pay."
"Listen, I beg you, listen to me and trust what I say. Some crazy guy ran up to me on the street and grabbed me. Just grabbed me for no reason. Then I get this voice in my head. It told me that if I slow down below 5 kilometers per hour, I will explode. Like in that movie Speed with the bus, except that it's with me."
Rod Fitzgerald hated it when people lied to him. "That's pretty funny, buddy. Can I see the bomb?"
"There isn't any bomb."
"Right. So what, pray tell, is going to make you explode?"
"I don't know. I just know that if I stop..."
Rod didn't catch the rest of what the crazy fool was saying because someone was blaring their horn at him. He realized that he was about to reverse into a parked taxi, so he hit the brakes. A centimeter further and he'd have caused a prang. The taxi driver, who had been sitting in his car, started yelling abuse out the window. It was all too much. He'd been on his way to work, where he had an important presentation to make. It was now 12:15 and it didn't look like he was even going to make it to the office by 5:30, let alone be ready to present. His fellow senior managers didn't like it when people were late. In all likelihood, they'd refuse to pay his car's damage bill as a punishment. Rod poked his head out the space where he'd once had a door and looked around to see where the delusional, accident-causing idiot had gone off to. He would have to pay for all of this. The fool was crossing a narrow alleyway. As he stepped off the gutter, he stumbled, then completely lost his footing and fell on his face. He screamed. Seconds later, the surrounding area was sprayed with Peter Steyer's guts as he exploded into thousands of fleshy pieces. Wednesday, late morning. Rory Henderson sat on the train, clutching his ticket like a sword. He was ready to stab it through the heart of the next ticket inspector foolish enough to cross his path. Today was shaping up to be a pretty lousy day. After being scammed of $50 by a fake transit officer and fined 4 times as much by a team of real ones, the stocky man had gone home to get changed for work. He'd spent the previous night at his girlfriend's place in the city and had to go all the way back to his mum's house to put some decent clothes on. It was a pain to travel so far when he started within walking distance of his workplace, but coming in dressed in shorts, thongs and a singlet would do nothing for his dreams of a promotion. When Rory arrived back home, he couldn't help but notice that his house wasn't there anymore. In its place was a smoking pile of debris. The police at the scene, one day you have a house, the next you have a scene, told him that a fire started in the kitchen and went out of control, namely because no one was around to control it. The moral of the story is this: don't trust your mother to turn the oven off before she goes out for the night. So Rory figured that since he had just become homeless, a promotion was even more important. Vowing to impart a few colourful words upon his mother when he finished work, he started to run back towards the train station. "Wait a second," one of the police officers on the scene had called, but he hadn't a second to spare. To make his morning all the more frustrating, Rory didn't see a single transit officer on his way to the city. Also, when he got off the train and left the platform, the ticket gates were open. With a muttered threat to Murphy, he headed over to the large telemarketing firm he worked in and caught the lift to the 15th floor. "You're over 2 hours late, son," his boss said the moment he arrived in the textbook-designed open-plan office. "And you look like you haven't slept in a week. Where are your work clothes?" "My house burnt down, sir. May I start doing a bit of overtime? I'm going to need the money." Tom Bauer looked Rory up and down. He was young, fit and good-looking, with the physique of someone who lifted lots of weights in the gym. He was also currently dressed like someone who was lifting weights in a gym, and that wasn't acceptable. "Rory, son, we have a dress policy here and you know it. Thongs and a singlet is not what I'd classify as smart casual. I'm sorry your house burned down, but that doesn't excuse lateness and a disheveled appearance." "My house burning down doesn't excuse lateness?" Rory exclaimed. He looked his boss up and down. Middle-aged, average height, glasses and a black moustache. Rory was sure he could take him. "Tell me then, Tom, what does excuse lateness?" "Don't use that tone of voice on your superiors, or you'll be packing your bags faster than you know it." "I don't have any bags to pack. My fucking house just burned down." "Rory," Tom warned, "you just take a few deep breaths, son. I could give you a serious reprimand for using that kind of language, but I'm willing to be compassionate because of what's happened. Go home, find yourself some decent clothes, and come back tomorrow. I'll let you have leave without pay for today." Rory Henderson took a deep breath in through his nose and let it out of his mouth. "That's very kind of you, Tom. Do you mind if I get a coffee from the lunchroom before I go? I'm a bit upset about losing my goldfish. I just hope it was quick for him in that horrible inferno." Tom Bauer crossed his arms. A split appeared in his comb-over, revealing a pasty white bald spot. "Go ahead. Just don't be distracting any of the staff with your sob stories." "Wouldn't dream of it." "Good. I'll see you tomorrow morning. 10 o'clock sharp." 10 sharp. Today was shaping up to be even more of a lousy day. It took all of his self-control for Rory to watch his boss retreating without yelling at him or stabbing him with a pencil. As much as he was tempted to take out his frustrations, he knew he had to do the sensible thing and keep his job. On the other hand, without so much as a hi to any of his colleagues, Rory walked through the call centre, past the plywood partitions and into the kitchen. Several people were in there having lunch, but he pointedly ignored them and headed straight for the hot drink vending machine. He pressed a button, watched as his black coffee made itself, then took it to the microwave and poured it all over the electronics. The kitchen erupted into activity as the microwave burst into flames. Rory quite calmly left them to their panic, worked his way back to the elevator, and caught it down to the ground floor. three security guards rushed into the lift the second the doors opened. Rory pushed his way past them and walked out into the foyer, which was practically devoid of all colour and life. As he was exiting the building, a man in his early middle ages came running towards him, his expensive suit in disarray. Rory hadn't seen him before, but he looked unfriendly, stressed, and humourless. Management. Without a doubt, management. Rory stepped aside and let the manager pass. "I bet he isn't going to get yelled at for his poor appearance," he mumbled as he walked out onto the street. It had clouded over during the 15 minutes Rory had been inside. A chill was in the air, so he picked up his pace. He considered stopping at the shops to buy some work clothes, but decided that he'd better not spend the money. There wasn't much left in his wallet, his bank account was empty, and his house had burned down. He might need to be frugal for a while. The events that took place next would long remain a mystery to Rory. He had been walking along the main street of the city, making his way to the train station. It was lunchtime and the city was full of business people out doing their banking and sitting around in cafes. Cars waited at traffic lights and a haze of fumes filled the air. Basically, it was an ordinary day. When a crazy-looking guy had come running towards him, Rory had snorted in disdain and moved out of the way. You pass wackos by the dozen every time you walk through the city. But as the man came closer, a strange feeling washed through Rory. They made eye contact, and he felt a sudden urge to vomit. Rory found himself falling towards the ground in what seemed like slow motion. As his body neared the footpath, the light, sound, and stink of the day faded until his senses culminated spectacularly in nothing. No sounds, no smells, no sights, no tastes, no feelings. Nothing. Complete sensory deprivation. He could have been dead. As a dream seems to occupy an indeterminable length of time, so did this strange lack of sensation afflict Rory. It could have been a minute or a whole week before he found himself crawling back up to his hands and knees. A flood of sound and light overwhelmed him as his senses returned.
"Get down, motherfucker!"
someone screamed from right beside him. Rory winced in pain. The sound felt like a blow to the head.
"Move and you're a dead man!"
A heavy weight pressed down on Rory's back and he felt something cold and metallic being forced against his skull.
"What's going on?" he managed to croak. "I blacked out."
"I'm placing you under arrest for murder, arson, malicious damage, assault and theft. Come quietly or I will be forced to restrain you." Rory felt hot breath on his face.
"And that means broken bones."
Two policemen were hauling him to his feet. One had already handcuffed him.
"What's happening?" he protested. "I passed out. How did I get here?"
Fear and confusion filled Rory as he looked blearily around the unfamiliar environment he was in. Somehow he'd left the city and was in one of those dilapidated suburbs usually inhabited by migrants and welfare cheats. It was getting dark, too. Must have been around 6 or 7 in the evening.
"One more word and you're in for a beating, scumbag."
The law enforcement officers dragged Rory to a nearby police car. The bewildered look he gave them must have been mistaken for a threat or a challenge, because one of them punched him hard in the kidneys. It took all of his energy just to remain conscious. As he was shoved into the back of a paddy wagon, Rory wondered how much lousier things could get. His house had burned down, his job was in jeopardy, he'd bribed a con man and copped a nasty fine, and he was being arrested for crimes he'd committed while unconscious. It wasn't a very good day. And things weren't going to get much better for good old Rory. Wednesday, mid-afternoon.
"Ian, thanks for coming into the office on such short notice."
"How you been?" the tall man replied as he sauntered into the office room and sat down on the arm of an armchair. At a table opposite him were two serious-looking men in serious-looking suits.
"We've been very busy, Ian,"
the larger of the two men replied. They were both pretty damn big guys, but one of them was about 6 inches taller than the other.
"We've noticed that you started up a little side career."
Ian Albright leaned back in his chair and gave the man an appraising look.
"Bob,"
he called himself. It was unlikely that more than a few people in the entire world knew what his real name was, and it was equally unlikely that Ian would ever find it out. "I take it you're talking about my new work with CityRail," he asked. "The transit officer thing?" The big man nodded in reply. His face was carefully devoid of expression.
Let me be straight with you, Bob, Ian said with a grin. I love that job. It makes me lots of money, it's extremely amusing, and I get a real kick out of tricking morons. You told me early on in the game that I should do nothing that might compromise my secret identity, and I haven't. I think that committing minor acts of fraud actually helps conceal that identity.
How? The smaller man asked. He was known as William, and hated being called Willy or Bill.
Well, Bill, it's simple. No one would expect a government secret agent to commit such petty crimes. If I ever got arrested for scamming civilians, do you think for a second they'd believe I was anything more than a doll bludger trying to rake in a bit of extra cash?
The two men looked at each other. Bob picked up a mug of coffee and took a long draught.
You're right, Ian. No one of your status should ever behave like that, so no one would suspect you of having that status. It's a good cover.
He frowned suddenly.
Are you bugged?
Ian Albright smiled. Unlikely, Bob. Aside from having to pass through all your screening equipment, have a look at what I'm wearing. Bike shorts. Don't you think I'd have noticed a microphone down there?
William peered over the desk at his employee's crotch, snorted, and leaned back in his chair.
Look, I'm sure you didn't call me in to give me a talking to about the things I do in my spare time. What's going down?
The men exchanged another glance. Bob drained off the rest of his coffee and spoke. As you are aware, there was an accident at the Star Market Systems headquarters yesterday afternoon. From all the reports we've received, it was clearly a suicide. Paul Hirsch stood up in the middle of a board meeting, broke his mug, then bashed his way out of the window. Our insider informed us that the meeting was comprised of both technology people and telemarketing people. A cover-up would have been impossible.
But a cover-up isn't necessary? Is that what you're saying?
Precisely. It seems to be nothing more sinister than an ordinary suicide.
Ian perked up. Was this poor bloke technology?
No, he was a genuine manager for the telemarketing front of the company. In fact, the most senior manager there. From the information we have gathered, it seems extremely unlikely that he had any idea what Star Market Systems actually do. They are good with their secrets.
Well, Jesus, I'd probably kill myself if I worked in the marketing industry. Just imagine how bad it would feel knowing that you're either going to get abused by your clients or trick them into buying some shit thing they don't even want.
The big men crossed their arms simultaneously, making it clear they were not interested in sociology.
Ian smiled in understanding. All right then. So there was a suicide amongst the senior management team. Surely you'd have only called me here if there was something more important than that.
Very true, said Bob with a curt nod. When Paul Hirsch landed on the ground outside Star Market's building, a woman who was close to the scene ran away. This wouldn't be so strange if she hadn't been walking her pram at the time. She abandoned her baby.
William continued the story.
Earlier today, we received some correspondence from one of our agents in the city. He saw a beaten-up woman standing outside an electronics store. This woman collapsed for no reason and started wailing about her baby. Then, a man who was near her ran off at full speed. We have confirmed that this woman is the same woman who left her baby at the suicide scene.
Ian waited expectantly for more. The two big men sat there staring at him, their faces blank. When it became clear they'd finished speaking, he stood up.
Is that it? Someone jumps out of a building and a witness goes mad. Should I go and assassinate the Prime Minister now?
William smiled grimly and pulled an envelope from his jacket pocket.
Here are the woman's details. Go and have a few words with her. See what she has to say about the incident. We're quite certain there's more to the story than Star Market Systems would have us believe.
The tall man reached across the table and snatched the envelope.
This job better start getting interesting. I didn't quit the bakery so a couple of paranoid assholes who think they're all big and powerful could order me to interrogate crackpots about their offspring.
Ian shook his head, got up, and walked towards the door. This was really starting to disillusion him. When he'd heard about the job, it had sounded really exciting, full of mystery and adventures. He'd thought it would be like the X-Files, but it was turning out to be more like Neighbours. Bob called to him just as he was pulling the door shut.
Oh, Ian, there's one more thing.
What?
See what you can find out about the spontaneous human combustion that occurred outside the CBD at 12:15 this afternoon, will you? Wednesday, early afternoon. Rod Fitzgerald stood panting in the lobby as he waited for the elevator to return to the ground floor. Running the few hundred meters from where he'd parked what was left of his car had tired him out a lot more than it should have. He was out of shape. Glancing irritably at his watch, he started pacing around and straightening his clothes. When the elevator arrived, it was packed full of anxious-looking business folk. They piled into the lobby, then dispersed out onto the street. With one disdainful glance, Rod entered the cramped metal box and hit the button for level 24. Nothing happened. The lift was disabled because of a fire in the lunchroom on level 15. During such an emergency, one could only catch the lift towards the ground. If you wanted to go up, you had to hope there was someone on a higher floor calling the lift. This made it kind of difficult for the fire brigade to get to the actual source of the fire. It wasn't a very intelligent system for the world's largest technology company. But then again, who would ever suspect they were the world's largest technology company with such a silly system? It was a good cover. By the time Rod had given up hope of the elevator ever arriving and walked up over 20 flights of stairs, he was significantly late for his presentation. Fortunately for him, the meeting had been postponed by half an hour due to a minor security breach. "What happened to you, Fincher?" asked the man that Rod sat next to. His name was Corey Fox, head of operations. A short, skinny man, Corey's job was to ensure that all of Star Market Systems' project ran smoothly and finished on time. He was also the private doctor of the business and provided a wide range of hard-to-get medication for the staff.
"Had a bit of a praying, Fox. The car's looking a lot worse than I do."
"Tough luck. I take it that's why you're late?"
"Yep. Why haven't we started yet?"
"Seems like a fire broke out in the call center, level 15. Mr. Security's checking the videos." Speaking of the devil, a brawny young man named Dane Hobson walked through the door and sat down at the table. At only 28, he was the youngest member of Star Market Systems' senior management team. The cold, unfalteringly serious expression on his face earned him the respect that his years couldn't manage on their own. Nobody questioned his status as chief of security. Dane handed a DVD to the chief executive officer and nodded curtly.
"This is the footage of the incident and the file of Rory Henderson, the perpetrator."
The CEO took the DVD and put it in his jacket pocket. "Thank you, Dane," he said with an appreciative smile. "The fire has been extinguished and we will investigate it thoroughly. My personal suspicion is that it is just the work of a disgruntled staff member, nothing sinister. I would doubt he has any idea about Star Market Systems' true nature. But let's not allow this distraction to take up any more of our time. We have business to get on with. Firstly, I'd like to talk about Paul Hirsch. All of us here bar Rod were present at the meeting yesterday. Is that correct?"
The dozen or so people sitting at the table nodded their assent.
"Mr. Fincher, are you aware of what happened yesterday?"
Rod shook his head. "Not in detail. All I heard was what was on the news. I spoke to Dane this morning to confirm who it was."
"Okay," said the CEO. "Paul Hirsch, as you know, was the most senior manager amongst the telemarketers. He had been working with us nigh on a dozen years, which also makes him the longest-standing employee who was not aware of the technology side of the company. Paul was a tribute to our ability to keep secrets." He turned to face Rod. "During our board meeting yesterday, he stood up at an entirely random interval, behaved erratically, then charged the window. It took him a few hits, but he managed to break the glass and jump to his death. After the initial shock period, I asked everyone if they knew why he would commit suicide or if they had anything to do with it. All present claimed ignorance. Now, Rod, I'm asking you as our head scientist, have you any idea why Paul Hirsch did such a thing? Were you conducting some kind of an experiment, testing a new drug?"
Rod Fincher, known to the outside world as Rod Fitzgerald, made a surprised noise. He was surprised because the CEO so flippantly asked him if he had committed a murder, albeit in the name of one of his many experiments. Usually these were not discussed, even amongst the most trusted of the senior management team.
"No, sir, this was not my doing. Any experiment in which I could make a man kill himself would be one I'd tell you about well in advance. If it had been me, you'd have known about it. And besides, I wouldn't use our own people as fodder. The CEO nodded, his face void of any judgments. One of his leading qualities was his ability to mask his suspicions, always having an air of impartiality. It was hard to keep any information away from the man, and harder still to know what he did and didn't know.
Good. Supposing that no one is being dishonest, we can rule out an inside job. However, that brings us no closer to understanding why a well-paid marketing executive would kill himself in such an unusual manner. All of us saw him go crazy before he smashed his way out of the window. I would like to know why.
Maybe he developed morals, suggested the head of communications. All present, with the exception of Dane Hobson, chuckled at that one.
Paul may have been so upset with life that he decided to kill himself, but I don't think it was quite that bad, said Jenna Albright with a lazy half-smile.
All eyes turned to her breasts.
Okay, enough jokes, said the CEO in a voice pleasant yet authoritative. I'd like you all to listen out for any hints of a motive for his suicide. Mr. Hobson, I trust you'll make this a priority. The chief of security nodded wordlessly, his expression remaining unchanged.
Thank you. Until we have more information, there's nothing else to say on the matter. I'd like to move on to a presentation from our top research and development scientist, Mr. Rodney Fincher. The project his team has been working on is now ready to be launched through Star Market Australia, so I believe it is as good a time as ever to show you what it's all about. Quite a different product to what we usually develop. But I shall say no more. Rod, would you care to take the stage?
Thanking the CEO, Rod made his way to the head of the table and plugged his laptop into a projector. His presentation appeared against a white screen, and he referred to it as he spoke.
Good day, everybody. I know that much of what the scientists do at Star Market Systems is considered to be a mystery by the bulk of you here. We are forever working on projects you know little or nothing about. This is partly due to the fact that our work is top secret, even for a top secret organization. It is also due to the fact that we are the world's top scientists in a range of fields, so we're pretty damn hard to understand. And also, guys, come on, you never ask.
Again, everybody except Dane Hobson laughed.
But before I introduce you to our latest creation, I'd like to talk briefly about some of the projects we've implemented during the past 12 months and discuss their progress. In all seriousness, it seems strange to me that some of you don't really know what goes on in the R&D department. Aside from its front of being involved in the telemarketing industry, this company revolves 100% around its technological discoveries and advances. Without the scientists, and I don't mean to undermine anybody's job here, you would have nothing but a call center full of fuckwits. Dane snorted. Thank you, Dane. My point is, we aren't selling toilet paper or coffee or George Foreman grills or whatever it is that those guys sell. We are selling weapons, drugs, and new technologies to foreign governments and other powerful organizations. Some of what we make can be used for good, but the majority of it is potentially immoral. If what we do was ever exposed, each and every one of us would be considered criminals of the worst caliber. As it stands, none of us have the criminal records we deserve.
I was caught shoplifting when I was 14, piped Rory Cox, head of operations.
All but one of the assembled people laughed.
Well, I think you all see what I'm saying, Rod continued smoothly. You live your lives as criminals for the sake of what we, the scientists, produce. Hell, we even have fake identities to protect our business. Not to mention the initiation ritual. Why go to this extreme if you don't even know what it is that your company is doing? Is it really just for the car and the millions?
What's the initiation ritual?
All eyes turned to Jenna Albright. Mouths hung open. Dane looked exceptionally uncomfortable as the CEO turned to face him.
Mr. Hobson? I thought only the men on our board had to do that, sir.
There was a very long, very uncomfortable pause.
I did it.
All eyes now turned to Miss Ella. Miss Ella was a tall, scrawny woman who was heavily involved in surveillance and monitoring. It was her job to record people's movements, both within Star Market Systems and without. Not that anyone would know the figures. Miss Ella had broken into approximately 712 houses to plant bugs and tracking devices. When she left work at the end of the day, not even Dane, as the chief of security, knew where she went. She was feared more than anyone else at Star Market Systems Australia, bar the CEO, because she was the most enigmatic. Her appearance only added to her intrigue.
No one that weak-looking should be responsible for doing what she did. Dane started to speak.
Yes, but we needed to make sure we could trust you.
And you don't need to trust Jenna? What about Karen? She must have done it too. There was another uncomfortable silence. The CEO broke it.
A quick word after the meeting, Mr. Hobson. It was not a request.
Sir, Dane acquiesced.
Taking the initiative after another short silence, Rod Fincher continued with his presentation.
I believe you each have a duty to keep yourself informed as to what projects the R&D Department of Star Market Systems have undertaken. I appreciate that a lot of what we do is kept quiet, but today we are making some of our recent projects public for those in management. This presentation I've been working on will be given to all of you after the meeting. I recommend taking a thorough look through it. For now, I shall summarise these works and introduce our new project, due to be launched shortly.
Rod spent the next 6 or 7 minutes telling the assembled managers about some of the inventions the scientists had designed and tested. Expressions ranged from avid interest, boredom, amusement, and disgust as he described the outcomes of these experiments. First, there was a weight loss tablet which, when tested on an unsuspecting fat guy, caused him such a loss of appetite that he needed to be placed on an intravenous drip. It was a full fortnight before he was able to bring himself to eat again. Deciding that the tablet wasn't the most practical solution to obesity, there was money in legal drugs as well as illegal ones. The scientists had instead sold it to an overseas dictator who was interested in using it during torture. Next had come an ingenious tracking and listening device which was shaped like a cockroach. It could function automatically, scuttling under the fridge or furniture if it detected movement, or by remote control. Its design was so realistic that if someone stepped on it, synthetic guts would spill out. They would never suspect it was anything but a real cockroach. There had been an array of tools and weaponry, such as a functional pen that doubled as a Class 4 laser. It was powerful enough to burn through steel, but it couldn't cut very deep. They'd gone through 8 test subjects in the process of designing this weaponry. Test subjects, meaning people, and gone through, meaning killed. The crowd favourite was a device that was identical to a $1 coin. When pressed in a specific way, it transmitted a short-range electrical impulse that triggered a strong sexual response from anyone close by. To demonstrate this, Rod had given the sales manager, Alex Bell, an erection. After detailing a few of the other projects that the research and development team had worked on, Rod Fitzgerald Fincher was ready to introduce their latest creation. Given that it was his own design, he was particularly proud of it.
"So, what is it that all children love?" he asked. "When you guys were little kids, what did you want your parents to get you for Christmas or for your birthdays?"
No one responded, but Rod was sure they were thinking of puppies.
"Let me tell you, I wanted a puppy. Or a kitten. I think you'll find it's a common desire for a 6-year-old. What's my point? Well, puppies turn into dogs, and dogs aren't as cute as puppies. I got Spot on my 9th birthday and loved her intensely for 6 months. After that, she only ever annoyed me with her barking and neediness. People love puppies, but they don't like dogs. Myself and the rest of the R&D team at Star Market Systems have come up with a solution to this problem."
There was an air of curious anticipation.
"Our genetically modified perma puppy."
Nobody made a sound. Wednesday, late evening.
"Aren't you going to get me to a hospital? I'm in pain here. Come on, this isn't right. Look at me. My leg is swollen to the size of a... I don't know, but it's bloody huge. And I've lost about a litre of blood. Look at my shirt. It's purple, for Christ's sake. It was blue before I passed out. How was I supposed to have committed arson in this state? Let alone murder anyone. I can't even remember a goddamn thing. I passed out on my way to the train station. That's it. Maybe I'm the victim of a beating or something and you've mistaken me for the culprit. That would explain my memory loss."
Probationary Constable Rick Blackman sighed heavily, folded his newspaper and placed it on the desk he was sitting at. He walked over to the cell door, where Rory Henderson was trying to squeeze his face through the peephole. The burly policeman pulled the shutter across and returned to sit with his offsider.
"You know the thing that always gets me about murderers?" he said. The other officer, Constable Allison Jacobs, smiled with polite interest.
What's that, Rick?
Instead of just pretending they don't know anything about the murder in question, they invariably blame it on someone else. There's always some convoluted story about what they were doing at the time. If you were truly innocent, you wouldn't have any reason to know anything about some guy who was killed in Queensland 3 years ago. Their excuses are so well thought out, they've obviously been concocted for a reason.
Allison thought this was rubbish, considering that the phrase most uttered by criminals in relation to the crime they've committed is, "I don't know what you're talking about."
Yes, that's an interesting point, that is.
If this little dick in there had half a brain, he'd be claiming you knew nothing about the murderer. I mean, who's going to believe that he's the victim? Does he think he's going to fool anyone?
I don't know, Rick.
I'll bet you he pleads not guilty. Don't mind the dozens of witnesses who will most likely testify against you, Rory. You didn't do anything. God, he'd have to be so stupid to deny his guilt. It will cost him a reduced sentence.
That wouldn't be too bright, Rick.
Rory slumped against the wall as the police officers discussed his lack of intellect. They didn't even have the decency to speak quietly enough that he couldn't hear them. No one had explained to him exactly what he'd done yet, but from the conversations he'd overheard, it sounded like he was in a lot of trouble. Murder, arson, assault, theft. How can you do all of that when you're unconscious? You can't. It's impossible. That could only mean he was innocent, or sleepwalking. The police officers abruptly stopped talking. There was a moment of silence, then a creaky door swung open and someone entered the room. Rory strained to hear what this softly spoken newcomer said.
Allison, Rick, I have some worrying news.
After we arrested the young man you have in custody, Brad Grass drove away from the scene, alone. He left his partner behind, which is unlike him. There were no other jobs to go to and he never returned to the station. This was strange enough, but we've now received a call from a concerned resident in our patrol who came home to find a police car through the front wall of her house. Brad is nowhere to be seen.
Is he answering his phone? Asked probationary Constable Blackman.
Rick, if he was answering his phone, do you think I'd be here telling you this? Use your brain.
Sorry, sir.
Allison spoke up.
What shall we do, sir?
Find him. Here's the address of the woman whose house he parked in.
Both of us? Asked Rick.
Both of you.
What about the prisoner?
What about him, Rick? He's locked in a cell. Just hurry up and find Brad, will you?
Rory listened as the police officers collected their things and walked away, leaving him alone in the brightly lit cell. His torn and bloody singlet was little protection against the cold. He'd lost his thongs at some point, and the police had confiscated his wallet. Full of despair, he lay down on the uncomfortably hard pallet and wrapped himself in a thin sheet. He had nothing left but a train ticket. Wednesday, night. Marnie heard a scratching noise coming from the open window. She looked over towards it, but the patient in the other bed was blocking her view. She wanted to get up to see what was making the noise, but getting up when you're in hospital isn't always easy. A rubber bag hung from a stand and fed her saline solution through a catheter in her wrist. If she wanted to go anywhere, she'd have to wheel the stand around with her and risk an accident. The room was plunged into momentary darkness as something blocked out the moonlight. Then there was a small thump as the same something landed on the carpet. It sounded like someone had just come in through the window. Whoever they were and whatever they wanted, they would find Marnie sleeping. She was asleep. Deeply asleep. Marnie? Marnie yelped and scrambled towards the back of her bed, pulling her blankets up around herself protectively. The patient next to her stirred and grumbled.
It's okay, Marnie. I'm a friend.
Who are you?
The tall man came closer, cautiously, as though approaching a cornered animal.
My name is Ian. I heard what happened to you and I want to help.
Marnie narrowed her eyes.
How did you hear about me? Everyone in this fucking place thinks I'm crazy.
I don't think you're crazy, Ian responded as he sat down on a chair near Marnie's bed. She edged away from him, knuckles white from gripping her blanket so tightly.
No woman would abandon her baby like you did without a damned good reason. I'm guessing you can't remember what you were doing during the night.
But who are you, Ian? How do you know what happened to me, and why the fuck didn't you just come in through the door?
Ian smiled. Visiting hours are over, Marnie. I'm with the police, and we are very concerned about what happened to you.
Show me your badge.
Excuse me?
You're with the police? Show me your badge.
Oh, I beg your pardon. Ian reached into his pants and produced a wallet. He flipped it open and handed it to the distraught woman, who took it and peered suspiciously at the badge.
Okay, she said. So you're a cop. That doesn't explain why you came in through the window.
For your own safety. We don't want anyone to know you're speaking to the police.
Fine, whatever. What do you want?
I'd like you to tell me exactly what happened to you. What can you remember of the past couple of days? Marnie released her grip on the blankets and lay back, staring at the roof. She spoke with a nasal dialect, a sign to Ian that she was from the country or possibly another state.
I was out shopping in the city with my baby. I was walking along the footpath, minding my own business like I always do. Nothing out of the ordinary. Nothing until I looked up and saw someone falling out of the sky. Then I felt a wave of nausea, like the worst kind of morning sickness.
What did you do next? Ian asked gently.
I don't know. I can't remember anything. All of a sudden, I was somewhere miles away, outside an electronics store with TVs on display in the window. It was morning. My leg was, is, in a hell of a lot of pain. My clothes were all torn up and covered with blood. I have no idea what happened to me. I could have been dead for all I can remember of last night.
The tall man was quiet. The man in the other bed wasn't.
Can you keep your voices down? He said. I'm trying to sleep here.
Marnie jolted in shock. She tensed up again, and Ian placed a calming hand on her shoulder.
I am sorry, my friend, he said to the patient. We will be quieter.
What are you doing here anyway? Visitors aren't allowed this late.
Much to Ian's surprise, Marnie said, he's my husband. We haven't had a chance to talk yet since I was brought here. The other man in the bed rolled away from them, snorting disdainfully.
Tell me, Marnie, what did you do after you woke up?
Marnie turned her gaze back to the roof.
I screamed. I was scared and hurting all over, and I had no idea where my child was. Someone called the police, who called me an ambulance as soon as they arrived. They talked to me for a bit, but I'd done nothing wrong, so they left as soon as the ambulance came. I'd been here all day now, telling skeptical fucking nurses that I have no idea what happened to me. They just keep trying to find out who hurt me, like this was domestic violence. I just want to see my baby.
Ian, who had been nodding, placed his finger against his lips and spun to face the door. Marnie regarded him with wide-eyed puzzlement. For a long moment, everything was still. Then all of a sudden, the door burst open and a tall figure came rushing into the room. This person was dressed in black clothes and a balaclava. Ian jumped to his feet and positioned himself in between the intruder and Marnie, who screamed.
Who are you? The newcomer hissed at Ian.
It was a woman.
Who are you? Ian retorted. I'm seeing my wife. You lie. She's not married.
Before Ian could argue it out, the woman leapt forward and grabbed his shoulders. Her foot hooked around and caught the back of his knee, sending him to the ground. Ian was no weakling, however, and he managed to grab the woman's arm and bring her down on top of himself. Marnie screamed again as the pair crashed into the side of her bed.
What's going on?
Asked the other patient as he leapt off the bed. Debilitating pain from an injured hamstring caused him to crumple to the ground, moaning. The woman in black pressed her knee into Ian's gut as she tried to pin down his arms. Ian thrashed around on the floor as he tried to escape from her grip, grunting with the effort. He managed to free an arm, and he grabbed one of the woman's breasts. The lights came on just as the intruder roared with pain and indignation. A nurse was standing in the doorway.
What's going on? She asked. Who are you?
As quickly as she'd launched at Ian, the woman sprang to her feet and charged the nurse. There was a loud thud as the nurse was hammered against the wall. Then, as quickly as she'd arrived, the intruder vanished around the corner. Ian wasted no time making his own escape. He told Marnie she'd be okay, stepped over the patient who was writhing on the floor, and exited via the window. It was only the second floor, so he jumped straight down into some bushes. The lanky man then scrambled to his feet and ran towards the tree which his bike was leaning against.
he'd be long gone before the nurse phoned the police. As Ian cycled past the hospital's emergency entrance, two paramedics climbed into their ambulance. A police officer had just called and told them a woman with severe abdominal wounds needed urgent medical help. End of recording, part 1. Eyes and Knives by Pete Malicki. www.petemalicki.com PETEMALICKI.com Yeah.